This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we celebrate International Women's Day by talking with two groups with very different approaches to social justice. We first speak with two members of the Granny Peace Brigade, one of whom has been arrested more than 40 times. Then we speak with the founder and director of the Social Justice Sewing Academy. They organize workshops for students of color, where they learn a range of skills and produce quilts with political messages. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. If you've attended New York State or city protests over the past few years, you might have seen a group of women that stand out from the crowd. A lot of credit is given to younger generations for their increasing presence in marches and protests, but this group is made up of women who have been protesting for decades. They call themselves the Granny Peace Brigade. The name is fitting in every way, as the group consists of all older women who have been at the forefront of many anti-war, anti-military, and counter-recruitment movements. After a group of these women were arrested at the Times Square Recruitment Center in 2005, they made their official debut as the Granny Peace Brigade to defend their civil rights in court. Over the next 13 years, as new members joined, their message grew louder. In conjunction with other groups over time, such as Code Pink and the Raging Grannies, the Granny Peace Brigade has worked to denounce and resist both local and global militarism, war, and the endless devastation to civilian life. Which brings us to today. We have here with us in the studio Joan Plune and Barbara Harris, two long-standing members of the Granny Peace Brigade and activists in their own right. Joan and Barbara, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi.
Let's talk about how the Granny Peace Brigade formed. Was it a group of individuals who intentionally came together, or was it a little less formal?
Well, I kind of know that because it was a little less formal. I was part of Code Pink at the time, and someone called a meeting in her apartment to various groups, WILF, Grey Panthers, Grandmothers Against the War, Code Pink, and it was an anti-military. They wanted to take an action. And I went to represent my organization, and they spoke about it based on an action taken in Tucson, Arizona, where a few raging grannies went to a military center to enlist, and they were refused, and the police came and escorted them away. And that was the end of that incident. We decided to follow that and try the same thing at the recruiting center at Times Square. So it became a group together, very cohesive, but from different organizations. And we met a few times, and we set up, we wrote a mission plan why we were there to bring our kids home. We were very much against this war. We were going to enlist, bring the kids home, our children and grandchildren, so they could live their lives, and we'll go and serve in their place. And that was our mission, and with more of things about peace actions.
And what year was that?
That was 2005 in October.
October 17th. And I was working at that time. And I saw them on television that night with Betty Brazel being dragged with her walker into a police car. And I was due to retire the next month. And I said to myself, hot damn, I'm going to find them when I retire.
Hot damn, indeed.
But the point is that they refused us, you know, entrance into the recruiting center. So we sat down in front. There's a ramp in front of that recruiting center and sang some songs that we had and read our mission statement a couple of times. The police had gathered. They knew we were going to be there. They find out very quickly, I guess, through the internet. And asked us to leave, get up and leave. And we sat and read our mission statement. And finally, the police came and had to, as Joan is saying, lift some of us up off the ground and put us into the wagon and took us to the neighborhood police station to be booked.
And each of you have a
long history of activism, which we want to get into in a few minutes, but I'm curious, did you notice a difference in how the police dealt with you in terms of handling you and arresting you than they might with some younger people, teenagers, people in their 20s?
All the time. The police with older people, older nonviolent people, and older people by necessity, I believe, are nonviolent, are usually, almost always, polite and gentle with us. On occasion, someone really doesn't like what you're doing, and they kind of press you a little hard, but most often, they're quite polite. Other than that, we do a lot, but people get a little old to put their bodies on the line.
Exactly. It gets harder.
It gets harder, yeah.
Broken bones. let's talk about some of the issues that you have covered. I know that you've had a drone, anti-drone campaign. You lobby against military recruiting in schools. Yeah. Let's talk about the recruiting issue first.
Okay, well, we have a very big interest in the militarization of youth in high schools. Any student under the age of 18 is considered a child. And under the United Nations protocol, they should not be addressed and meeting military recruiters until they're 18. So unfortunately, in the city, we do have militarization in our high schools. We have 18 JROTC programs throughout the city.
And that's Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps.
That's what it is. And it is what it says, Junior Officers Training Corps, because their goal is to get these kids to enlist. Although they will not say that or write it up in their documentation, they just want to do it. And it doesn't serve our city very well because taxpayers support the programs. And the Granny Peace Brigade, where they're at council meetings all the time wanting to reallocate the monies for that program and put it into things we feel that have been cut for education, like arts and music and coaches and guidance counselors and all the things our kids really need for a good education. We don't need a military education.
Now, let's talk exactly how much money this city is devoting to that. I read in an article that covered your, testimony before the city council that it's estimated $1.5 million was allocated in 2016-17 for the JROTC budget, and that the classes take the place of regular classes for students who participate. This isn't that widely known. I had not really heard about that. What was the response to your efforts to draw attention to that?
Well, first of all, it's $1.6 million, I'm sorry, for 2017-2018. What brought our attention to it was, number one, is the curriculum that's taught, which is a military-designed curriculum. So the wars we fight are good wars, and we're the good people, and we save the world. They don't address what's really happening the way it is in the news. The instructors are retired military personnel, and they are not New York City certified, which should not happen. They should not be there. And there are two of these military people in each class as they're teaching. One will have a college degree. The other one is going for college credits and hopefully will get a degree. But there is no certified teacher in the room. And this is very disturbing to some of the council members to whom I've spoken. They don't think it's legitimate.
Do students elect to take these classes, and do their parents have to approve it?
They do elect. I think they do have to approve it. A lot of parents think it's good, that it'll be good discipline for their kids. They promote that. And they are intrigued by the program in the sense of the rifles that are part of it.
What do you mean, the rifles that are part of it?
Well, one of the big parts of the program, besides this curriculum that is not good and the fact that the teachers aren't certified, is that they have drills with rifles. They're artificial facsimile rifles. They drill, they march, they are in parades, they go into the school assemblies. They get a uniform that they can wear. They are military in the school on those days when they're doing that.
And are we talking high school level, I assume?
It's all high school, but
yes. No, there's one in a junior high school in Bushwick. A National Guard group in a junior high school in Bushwick. I found them marching at the Puerto Rican Day Parade that honored Rivera Lopez.
Yes, Oscar.
I brought you actually a picture of them.
Oh, great. We'll try to post that on our website.
No, but high school kids are 14, 15, 16, 17, some are 18, but they start high school at 14.
And I'm curious, does the high school get a benefit out of having these classes there? Why would they consent to this?
Well, I think they like it. They think they're helping their children become better citizens. It hasn't been proven. I have documentation and dissertations which show that that doesn't happen. The dropout rate is greater than regular public school. Going on to college is greater for those who are not in the program. But the thing about JROTC, they can disenroll a kid, and that you can't even enroll in if you are really like obese or heavy or have a physical handicap, because then you aren't part of the military. I mean, you couldn't get into the military either for some of these reasons. So if you see a parade of our JROTC kids, they're in good shape, girls and boys, because mm-hmm. that's a requirement.
Do recruiters then come to these schools, say when they're seniors, to try to enlist students?
Well, they come to career fairs. High schools have a career mm-hmm. fair. And I've been at one. For some reason, Murray Bertram High School let us have a peace table, which was really nice. Mm-hmm. So it was in the cafeteria. The first three tables when the students would enter, you know, juniors and seniors, was Army, Navy, Marines. Mm-hmm. With every kind of glossy thing they could have, you could, if you could do 20 push-ups, you got a mug. Mm-hmm. But you also signed your name, address, and telephone number.
All your personal identifying information.
They want to be able to reach out to you. And then we have the colleges and the community colleges mm-hmm. and businesses and work programs.
The military hangs around in the subway stations after school. So in downtown Brooklyn, in the Pacific Street Station, they're often there after 3 o'clock when the kids from, it used to be Sarah J. Hale, get out of school. They get them to sign up. I believe it's not the final word, but they sign their names and get more information.
So just to sort of get at what you've been able to accomplish, if you're able to table at some of these events, do you provide alternatives, ideas for alternatives to military enlistment?
Well, first of all, we don't get invited very often, but yes, we do. And in fact, on March 8th, we have parent-teacher conference night where we will be in front of about 12 high schools giving out information to parents as they enter the school to have a meeting with their child's teacher. And we have options for life after high school, all non-military options and, you know, websites they can go to and scholarships that are available. There are many scholarships for kids. They don't have to be the star in the class to get it, and they don't know about it. It's in English and Spanish. And then our second flyer talks about questions you should ask recruiters. Because when they come to engage you, you know, it's all wonderful. They don't even know that they sign a contract for 6 years. You know, you don't just come in and quit. I've had young fellows say to me, well, if it doesn't work out, I'll quit. So you don't quit. That's dishonorable. You can't do that. Or they'll get a certain kind of job, or they'll be able to learn something else, which for most of these young people, they will just be in the troops. And with President Trump, enlarging the financial budget, the budget for the military by, $90 billion, and cutting the education budget by $9 million, you can see where the country's priorities are. We are a military-industrial complex, mm-hmm. and it's taken out on our kids in high schools. And the fact that they're carrying the rifles is very troubling after the incident in Florida. And if you want to keep guns out of the school, How could you have rifles in the school?
Well, this leads me to ask about a campaign. This leads me to another issue that you've lobbied on behalf of, and that is no more war toys. I read that you went to, I believe, a Target store in Brooklyn. What happened there?
We've actually done a couple of things around no more war toys. We, on two occasions, if you remember, there used to be a Toys R Us in Times Square. On two occasions, we hijacked the Ferris wheel, and we got into the Ferris wheel with banners and sang peace songs as it went around, and we wouldn't get off. It was a wonderful two times.
It really was great, and we hung the banner on the side, and people were all watching because you remember it's a very open area.
Right, yeah.
So when we finally came out and they escorted us past security, we were singing, "All we are asking is give peace a chance."
And they gave us our money back.
The ride.
I bet they did.
At Target, we went up to, if you've been in the Brooklyn Target, it's a two-floor store, and the toys are on the second floor. And we took shopping carts and loaded the shopping carts with all the war toys. And, of course, at that point, security saw what we were doing. We had on our yellow schmatas, and we had all the war toys in our shopping carts, and they surrounded us. And it was a shoplifting expedition. We were going to leave with them. And they escorted us down the elevators. We were escorted out, clearly.
Tell us a few examples of these war toys. Is it G.I. Joe? Did I read there's a G.I. Jane?
There is something
a girl,
like that
G.I. Joe?
Yes, there is G.I. Jane. No, but they were selling these huge guns.
Nerf guns.
They're repeater guns. And the child, just the packaging of it was disturbing. The child is in like a military uniform with this gun, and you could get 40 bullets, pellets out very quickly. And
they still carry it.
They do.
They do have a lot of these guns. And they had drones once, which was, and two of us went over to where they were just displaying the drones. I was with Jenny and Anne. And we went as like grandmothers interested in the drone as a toy.
Right.
So he was displaying it, and then he showed us how it works. And it takes off, and it flies away, and we were at Toys R Us down through the Ferris wheel to the first floor. He ran off. And that was the drone moment.
Well, let's talk more about drones, because I understand you've conducted actions in upstate New York to protest drones. Mm-hmm. What has your message been about drones?
No drones.
No drones. And
that's simple. I suppose we would be for drones for humanitarian uses. There are some good uses for drones. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But none of them are military.
Okay, so you're opposed to military uses.
Militarization.
Yeah. What has been the response to your actions, and what have some of the actions been about drones?
Well, I've been upstate a lot, a number of times, with the upstate campaign against drones. And basically, we do actions in front of Hancock Air Force Base, which houses, I believe, the 176 attack wing. And they man drones in Afghanistan and Pakistan from the Hancock Air Force Base in right outside of Syracuse.
Now, what kind of security do they have there? It sounds a little dangerous.
Well, again, we're old. We can't get into the base at all. And so we are standing in the driveway outside of it. Sometimes they don't know we're coming. I believe occasionally they probably do know we're coming. And we stand there and we block the entrance and the exit. There are other entrances to the base. Certainly we wouldn't impede any emergency vehicles. We're not there to do that. But we try not to let any cars into the base or out of the base. And they're forced to divert traffic to other entrances to the base. It's very serious. They arrest us now every time, although it seems more recently they're less interested in sending us to jail. I did spend at one point 10 days in jail awaiting bail, and at one point we
10 days?
At one point, I spent.
Oh, it's like,
I spent 10 days.
Right.
Awaiting bail.
Ten days.
Five of us were arrested, and they set bail at $27,500 for the five of us, and we just simply didn't have it, and weren't going to get it, and they could just keep us if they wanted. I believe the most we could have served was 15 days. So after 10 days, they had to let us out, you know.
How many times have you been arrested, Joan?
I don't know.
Many.
Many, over 40, well over 40.
Over 40 times.
Sure. Yeah.
And Barbara?
Once. That made the difference.
Yes. What do you mean that made the difference?
It just took me that I have to continue speaking out against the JROTC program and the rights of our kids to get a good education. I'm focused on that in high schools. It's a national program. We do Parent Teacher Night, which we will be doing, and we do ASVAB. Do you know the ASVAB test?
No.
Okay, that's a military program that's offered to high schools throughout the country on a, you know, open engagement. They have developed an ASVAB test. It's the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. And if you were 18 or 19 or whatever and go into a recruiting center, that's the first test they give you because it's a two-hour test examining all your abilities educationally and intellectually, your test scores. But it also gives the military your name, address, telephone number, ethnicity, social security number, every single piece of data they want to know about you. And they give it to the schools, and many schools throughout our state give it to kids in their district because it's also called a career exploration program. And the results of the test will be given to the guidance counselor so he or she can review a career opportunities with the student. But the military glean all of this information from the test. It's put on a Department of Defense database that's called JAMRS, and it stands for the Joint Advertising and Marketing Research System. It's marketing and research, meaning they will release this information for marketing and research for profiling and enlistment when it goes to recruiters. Because if the kid was 15 and took the test, they wouldn't look at it. But if they are of age, ready, the recruiter will start calling them. And I have heard from many parents that are so upset. The last thing they want to hear is a recruiter on the phone asking for their child or letters in the mail. Mm. And I know probably Joan as well as I have talked to fathers and mothers who have suffered from this result of meeting with recruiters who engage their child and promise them everything, including making a hip-hop record, one fella told me.
Well, I can imagine that if a child scored very well, they would be then persistently called by recruiters.
Right, if even fairly well, because we have a problem with the results of our kids' graduation rates and what they can do. And I know the recruitment eliminates if you're overweight or handicapped, or if you graduated in 5 years by the skin of your teeth. But they do go to underserved neighborhoods.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah. Is there a geographic bias in terms of neighborhoods with fewer resources?
Yeah, and they're at public schools. They're not at private schools. Yeah. They're at certain schools, and that's what the schools we'll cover on Parent Teacher Night, to offer these options, alternative options. But in the summertime, they'll be at the beach. Sometimes they'll set up a stage with music. And again, they can give you something, sign your name. They're there. They're around. Guidance counselors have all the information, Army, Navy, Marine brochures, so they can talk about it if they want. That is an option for a kid when he or she is 18. But in the school, when they're younger, you can't tolerate it.
And Barbara, you're a former educator, correct?
Yes, I am. Was.
Yes.
No, I am.
Joan, you were a Freedom Rider.
I was a Freedom Rider. I was a 1961 Freedom Rider. It was funny. For so many years, nobody knew it. Nobody was interested in it. And then after it came the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, and suddenly we're called out everywhere. And it's been kind of exciting. Yesterday, our friend Phyllis and I, Phyllis was a civil rights worker in Mississippi in 1964, went to a class at Hunter, where I've gone for the last 5 years, and we get to talk with the young people in the class and get to hear what they think and what they think ought to be done. And it's been kind of exciting in later years.
Have you been an activist since then?
People think I've been an activist all my life, but actually that's not true. I was for many years of it, I was a single mother. So after the Freedom Rides, I did a few more things. I was in anti-Vietnam War groups and was arrested in D.C., for that. But then I had children, and I wasn't going to be arrested as a single mother raising children. And so it really wasn't until I retired in 2005, when the Grannies were formed, that I became active in a way where, once again, I'm available to be arrested.
I want to make a disclosure here. I work at the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute. We have a building of activists, and the Grannies are one of the groups who are with us. And it is really always a thrill to see you coming in and having your meetings, because you are such an inspiration to a lot of the young groups in our space as well, and to me personally.
We're actually a great group. I mean,
you are.
I have been to meetings of other groups where the meetings just drone on.
Pun intended.
You know? Yeah, really. They're just so slow and nothing happens. You just want to go home. And you go to our meetings, you get 15 of us in one room, and we have one idea after another. And it's an exciting group to be a part of.
It is. It's a real sisterhood. And really supportive of each other. Even though I'm focused on one area, I'll show up for someone else, and they will show up for us. You know, it's remarkable. I always think to myself, how did I make this choice? And how fortunate I am as I'm getting older to be part of it.
Are there any issues we haven't touched on that you'd like to tell our listeners about that you've focused on either in the past or now, especially with this new administration?
Yeah, I'd like to mention solitary confinement, which is an issue in the New York State Assembly right now. And I'm part of a group, New York CAIC, C-A-I-C. It's nycaic.org.
What does that stand for?
New York Campaign Against Isolated Confinement. We have a bill we're going to get passed. It's about to go into the State Assembly. It just got out of Corrections Committee, and it was voted out of Corrections Committee. And basically, it limits solitary confinement to not more than 15 days in a row, not more than twice in 60 days, and then it has extreme limitations on when it can be used and who it can be used on. And it's called the Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Confinement Bill, HALT.
HALT.
HALT, yeah. And it's going to be a very important piece of prison reform. And right now, the time is now for prison reform.
Is that because people are paying attention to it a bit more?
Yeah, I think people are paying attention to it. We have released elderly prisoners.
Yes, another one of our groups.
Another one of the group at the A.J. Musty Institute. And prison reform right now, I believe it's in the air. And I think this solitary bill will pass, anti-solitary bill.
Right.
And we have a group, a couple buses going to Advocacy Day on March 13th. And if anybody is interested in going, they should go to the website, nycaic.org, nycaic.org, and sign up. You can sign up online.
Now, is there a website for the Grannies in case people are interested? And do you accept new members if they meet your criteria?
Old and female.
Old.
Mainly female. Mainly female.
Female activists.
Female activists.
Who aren't afraid.
You know, and young people have occasionally expressed interest in joining us, but they really need to be with other young people. And so I believe our bottom age is in the 60s somewhere.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. It's also that we're free during the day most often and others
exactly.
aren't.
Exactly, right. Yeah. But, do you travel a lot in terms of going upstate for actions?
I do.
Well, I've only been to Albany on something like privacy issues in SFAB and that.
Oh, right, stuff. Right.
Work with the Board of Regents and the Commissioner. I wanted to mention that when we write to the Chancellor of the New York City Board of Education, we've written as grannies about JROTC. She doesn't respond. We've written about rifles. She doesn't respond to us. We've had Council Member Drone write to her. She didn't respond to him.
Did you say Council Member Drone?
Yeah, Drone,
oh,
D-R-O-M-M. He's from Queens.
I have Drone on the mind.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I call him Drum. Just
no, there are other council members that are on our side, but she won't answer anyone. And I don't know why. She always says, I'll look into it, I'll look into it, I'll look into it. So
they're on our side, but they don't do anything mm-hmm. about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really discouraged in many ways with our city council because they don't, they know we're right about it. Most of them know we're right about it, and they don't do anything about it.
Well, you surely have principled stances on the issues that we think are key right now. And the gun violence and the weaponization and militarization of our youth in schools is especially disturbing.
As A.J. Musty would say, there's no way to peace. Peace is the way. So we have to seek peaceful
yes.
solutions.
A wonderful note on which to end. What's your website again for the grannies? Yeah.
GrannyPeaceBrigade.org.
GrannyPeaceBrigade.org.
Uh-huh. And if anyone wants to email, it's grannypeace@gmail.com.
Okay.
Go to our website. It's very interesting.
Thank you both, Joan and Barbara. It's really an honor to have you in our studio.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. In 1989, an exhibition at the American Craft Museum offered a new appraisal of quilts in the United States, suggesting that quilting derives from African design and even reflects the improvisational nature of the music in Africa. Historians Jacqueline Tobin and Raymond Dobard also claim that African American slaves may have used a quilt code to navigate the Underground Railroad. Such patterns as the so-called wagon wheel, tumbling blocks, and bear's paw were passed down from one generation to another and seem to have held secret messages to assist in guiding slaves to freedom. Sarah Trail began sewing at age 4, and by 11, she was teaching others how to sew. In 2012, Trayvon Martin was murdered in Florida. Sarah and Trayvon were the same age, 17, and his death stirred in her a need to do something on behalf of social justice. She created an oversized portrait quilt of Trayvon and gave it to his mother at a Black Lives Matter event. Sarah began to study ways to apply her talent at sewing to social justice, given its importance as a tradition during slavery. She saw the potential in quilting to encourage discussions about current social issues. A grant from UC Berkeley for a 6-week summer program serving high school students of color from the Bay Area helped her to create the Social Justice Sewing Academy. Joining us now to talk about the academy is its founder, Sarah Trail. Sarah holds a bachelor's degree from UC Berkeley and a master's in education from Harvard. She is the author of the book Sew with Sarah and the subject of the DVD Cool Stuff to Sew with Sarah. She has her own line of fabrics and a collection of designs created for Simplicity Patterns. Sarah, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Sarah, how did you begin sewing and what did it mean to you as you were growing up?
I began sewing because my grandma taught me. My grandma used to let me sit on her lap as a young child and really just steer the fabric. I wasn't much tall enough to reach the foot pedal, but growing up, it was a history of culture that my family had continuously been seamstresses, and I sewed because it was a fun hobby that just allowed you to express yourself.
Oh, so you were at a sewing machine and not sewing by hand.
Correct.
That's pretty young to be at the machine, even if you were just using the pedal.
Yeah, no. It was, my parents had a lot of trust.
Tell us about the Grace Temple Sewing Studio.
My pastor, Pastor Henry Kelly, would see me every Sunday for Youth Sunday, bring the things that I had been sewing to just feature. Every once a month, we have a Youth Sunday where kids can bring in straight-A report cards or any, you know, trophies or certificates or anything that we just did throughout the month. And for my features, I'd always bring in the things I made. So the kids would just be like, wow, like, that's so cool. How'd you make a dress? Or how'd you make PJs or a backpack or this quilt? And so soon after all the buzz is going, I was like, you know, Pastor Kelly, if you bought enough sewing machines, I'd love to teach the rest of the youth how to sew too. So he bought 15 sewing machines, and every Sunday after church, for all four Sundays, we'd run this free sewing studio where kids' parents would let them stay after the services to learn how to sew.
That is amazing that he would buy all those machines and have faith in you.
It was really the faith in me, but also the support of mentors. We had members in the congregation who'd volunteer as well, and then we put a call in the local community. So we had a lot of just older quilters coming in, not to our church service, but just to the after sewing studio part, to just help teach all these kids how to sew.
Now, let's talk about the quilting part. You started making clothes and different things, as you've said. Was quilting a part of that when you were very young?
I started with quilts. Quilts was just an easy way to learn quarter-inch seams and just learn, I guess, sewing foundations and basics of how to use a rotary cutter and how to measure and do math to, you know, create precise points that are, you know, exemplified in quilts. But as I got older, I moved into a designer phase. I wanted to upcycle and create my own things. And then I kind of circled back to quilting once I got into college and high school.
I actually have made a few quilts years ago. And I loved the process of finding all the different fabrics. And you can really, there are no bounds to your creativity. When did you start thinking of using social justice images for the quilts?
Really, once I got to Berkeley. In high school, I would make quilts just on, you know, fun things, fun colors, and learning new techniques like paper piecing and Raj applique. But once I got to UC Berkeley, my levels of awareness was really opened. I learned about systemic injustices, and coming from, you know, relatively affluent suburb, you know, my parents, I've been blessed with a pretty middle-class lifestyle. But once I got to Berkeley, I was able to just volunteer in local schools and see firsthand the inequities of all these kids that are in fourth grade but can't read. Like art classes there, they had, you know, broken pencils and crayons and dried out markers. And I was just like, wow, I've been in pretty art-heavy programs all my life. But just being able to see the lack of access and equity that a lot of kids, particularly marginalized kids, of color in certain urban communities, I was just like, you know, let's bring a free sewing program there. So at first we started, you know, like, hey, look, let's just make PJs, like, let's make tote bags. But the conversations we were having and other things that were going on, it was like political awareness was kind of always in the forefront. Like, we're making, you know, PJ pants, but someone in Oakland was just choked out and killed by police. So clearly while we're having this dialogue and discussion while sewing, these issues of systemic injustice and just social justice and just overall awareness are always being prevalent. So I made a quilt to Trayvon Martin a couple weeks. I started it after he was murdered just because that murder really stood out to me. He was like, I think his birthday was like less than 8 days before mine, and we were born the same year. So I was just like, wow, to be walking through a neighborhood and have your life just taken from you senselessly, that really hit home. So after that, kids were like, well, I care about this issue. And everyone had their own issues they were carrying. Some kids were facing gentrification, being evicted with their grandparents. Some kids were, you know, continuously being harassed on public transportation by grown men and just being overly sexually exploited, not in the sex trafficking way, but just in the way that men interact with them. So we started to just use sewing as an outlet of expression to just, you know, resist in a sense.
I haven't seen the picture of the quilt of Trayvon. How long did that take you, and did you draw the images that were on the quilt beforehand? How does that work?
Yes, so Trayvon is about maybe 6 feet by 5 feet. And it took me maybe like 4 to 5 months of just every day after school working on it. So typically I'll look at a photo that I want to make a quilt out of, then I'll start drawing in sketches, but when I draw, I have to draw in color block shapes, because unlike painting, with fabric you can't blend. So I have to look at the different planes of the face and realize, what am I going to highlight? What shadowing needs to be there? What color palette am I going to work with? And like, what features matter? Like in Trayvon, his eyes really mattered, as did his eyebrows. And of course his hoodie, which was significantly, you know, reminded people he was wearing a hoodie. And then additionally, I added hoodie strings on it.
How do you get the appropriate fabrics in the colors and textures that you want to help bring that image alive?
I go to at least 3 to 5 clothing stores and just pull out everything that I like. I'll buy a little bit of everything. Then as I start playing and making the design, I'll go back to the specific stores to buy more of anything that I really need. But really, it's about just going to lots of stores. I went to thrift stores. I wanted to incorporate some fabric, some reused and recycled fabric. I cut up lots of things. Like if I have a shirt that's gets a hole in it, I'll cut it up and incorporate it in a quilt.
I understand that you presented this quilt to Trayvon's mother at a Black Lives Matter event. What was her reaction, and how did you feel doing that?
She was really, really just kind of blown away. I think his death was really the catalyst for the Black Lives Matter movement, of a lot of people whose voices have typically been silenced, just saying they don't, you know, they're ready to stand up. They've had enough. As Maxine Waters says, you know, the time is now, or time's up. Like, we're tired of waiting. We're tired. We're no longer going to be passive and just allowing senseless murders to repeatedly happen. Overall, she was just tears, a lot of tears, but tears were there before the quilt. I think the quilt just meant a lot in the sense of she recognized that people, like, valued her son and people understood her pain. And typically quilts are seen as, like a social sense of warmth and belonging and comfort. And so to juxtapose a murder on a quilt, which is usually used to comfort and warm and, you know, take care of people, you know, it's an interesting medium to make things that aren't necessarily warm and inviting.
Sarah, how much did you know about the history and legacy of quilting in America during the sort of formative years when this became not only an art, but the subject of your really wonderful group?
So I know traditionally textiles were used to convey important cultural information, and they often played a central role in festivities and ceremonies. Like, I had a background knowledge that, like, throughout African continent, men and women and children wove cloth, often from, like, you know, the age of 3 and 4. Cloth was used to be used as a currency and had a lot of value. But with current, I guess, like, child labor, things are made by young people. Like, if I've done a lot of research on, you know, where I buy brands of clothes, but young kids are sewing in other countries for pennies. So it's like sewing necessarily isn't something that takes a lot of skill. It just takes a lot of practice and access to the resources and freedom to mess up and not be chastised for it. Unlike painting or pottery, which takes, I think, at least innately more talent, sewing is so flexible in the sense that if you cut something and you don't like it, you don't have to sew it down. You can just remove it. You get a lot of room to mess up. You get a lot of room to have help. Sewing is such an intergenerational hobby. Older people can mentor young people. There's sewing circles. Sewing has just been rooted in community since slavery.
That's a really good image for us, and leads us into question about how you formed the Social Justice Sewing Academy. I understand that when you were an undergraduate at Berkeley, you became interested in participatory action research. Can you talk about what that is and your project there?
Yes, participatory action research is allowing youth to use research to change their own conditions. For example, a YPAR project would be 5 high schoolers saying, hey, we feel our dress code is really unfair, or we don't like our student lunches. They do a quantitative methodology of maybe surveying 300 kids in the school, and then they can write a policy report or make recommendations to then give to administration saying, hey, we've done the research, this is how we feel. If possible, would you be open to considering these means? So particularly in my YPAR project, I've done 2. The more successful one was kids took, they had a college pipeline program for the top 5% of the class. So everyone who's like, you know, 3.8 GPA or higher had access to this particular program that would prepare them with college apps and personal statement help and resume writing workshops. But the people who didn't have that GPA still wanted to be in that program, but they just didn't have access because they didn't have the top 5% GPA. So they did a whole research project on how other kids who had 3.1s and even kids with 2.8s would still like access to learning about the college application statement process and personal statement help and just that level of mentorship. And after they did that research project, they presented to the principal, and the principal made it open and changed the timing. Instead of having one period of the top 5% high school class, he opened it up during lunch where anybody could go.
You received a grant from UC Berkeley for a summer program that served high school students of color from the Bay Area. And was that sewing related? I understand that sort of helped create your Social Justice Sewing Academy.
It did. It was all sewing related. So it was called the Stronach Prize, and it's for undergrads who have a social impact project they want to implement after graduation. So applying for that grant gave me the space to work at UC Berkeley to buy sewing machines so kids could come for food, snacks. It really was the pilot seed funding to run SJSA and really just test out in 6 weeks, because I teach kids who've never sewed before how to make a social justice art quilt from start to finish.
Describe for us, if you will, what happens when you get a group of young people together in a sewing situation. What kinds of things do you talk about? Do people share their ideas before they start sewing?
Yeah, so typically in an SJSA workshop, we come in, we start with a restorative justice circle of sharing names, building community, then we kind of bring in issues that we care about. So people will say, I'm really passionate about whether it's clean water in Flint, or whether it's gentrification in the Bay Area, or income inequality in Silicon Valley. Kids will share what they care about, and then we'll start to have conversations. What do those trends like? What ideas? What do they look like? Then we start with a pattern, I guess, solidification activity where people design a pattern, then they show someone who they hadn't already previously shared their idea with. And if the other person can figure out, based on just the drawing, what the person's social justice issue is, then it's a good pattern. So it's like that accountability to verify that the general public will be able to understand what your art means.
That's fascinating. And what have you observed that students experience as they go through the whole course of a workshop, for example? Do you see that it brings out new sides of their consciousness or their personality?
Yes, I think definitely I've gotten a lot of feedback from the young people that they really hadn't thought of issues in that way, and they haven't necessarily found a convenient way to share their voice. Like sometimes, you know, they'll be like, well, I post on Instagram about social justice issues, but being able to use art as the medium and access to the materials, the free materials at that, they feel empowered. I think most people leave with a sense of, you know, I just made this art. I'm feeling, you know, I'm on fire about it right now. What can I do? What's next?
And so you do provide the fabrics and the thread and the materials?
The fabric, thread, needles, sewing machines, everything we provide.
And how long does it typically take someone to conceive of an idea and then complete their quilt?
So in a quilt, maybe I'd say total maybe 25 hours.
And how many hours is a class?
1 to 2.
I see. Do you display them when they're finished with them? Is there like a little
we
show?
We do.
Okay.
Yeah,
nice.
So depending on where it is, really the part of SJSA is to facilitate them outside and in the greater community. So if we do a workshop in Oakland, I'll definitely try to get a quilt show in San Jose or in San Francisco. But then it travels, and I think a really cool part of SJSA is geographically the issues that are brought up and raised are prevalent based on the cities they're in. In Atlanta, the kids are concerned with educational inequality far more than the kids in the Bay Area are. In Chicago, the kids are far more concerned about police brutality than the kids in Texas are. So geographically, like having these group of young people raise up their issues and they write artist statements that accompany the quotes, it's a really powerful way to just understand, like see the city through the perspective of marginalized youth and understand how they're feeling and what issues they're concerned with.
So let me understand, do you travel to other cities or do students come to you?
I travel. So usually there's no physical headquarters for SJSA. The P.O. box is in Antioch, which is where I live. But for example, a high school in Denver, Colorado, just emailed us and said, hey, we want to have a workshop. So currently I'm figuring out when I could take off work, go down there, bring all the fabric, ship everything, and have a workshop in Denver, Colorado with their youth.
Oh, so then would you stay for the duration of their finishing their quilts, or is it a sort of a one-shot, you start them off?
That would be a workshop of a block. So the difference is there's quilt workshops where kids take 25 hours and make their own mini quilt, and then there's block workshops where everyone makes a 15-inch block, and then after all the blocks are done, I sew them into one collective quilt.
Oh,
so
I love
that. So two different strands.
Two strands.
So we don't have... Yeah, so it's like if we have the kids, the same kids, for a repeated, prolonged amount of time, they can make their own quilt from start to finish with sewing machines and really in-depth, heavy instruction, applique, raw edge, freezer paper techniques. But if we only have the kids, say, 3 to 4 hours, then all the kids would make a block, and then the blocks would be put together after they've been embroidered into this beautiful collective quilt that features every student's individual block, but in one community quilt.
Okay. I want to take one of these classes now. What about adults who see this and want to do it?
So the adults, honestly, are the biggest part of the community quilt. So in a community quilt block workshop, the kids will make the art using fabric, scissors, and glue. They'll use light dots of glue to cut down and glue their art, and then I'll mail their block to an embroidery volunteer across the U.S. who's going to spend 15 to 20 hours hand embroidering their block with the thread to actually make the quilt block a sewn block.
A what block?
A sewn block. So it'll go from fabric and glue to mailing it to an embroidery volunteer who's going to, because I don't have 10 to 15 hours to have each kid completely embroider their block. Kids are only allowed to sew in the week-long making quilt workshops.
Okay, this is amazing. How did you locate the places to send them to be embroidered?
So I emailed quilt stores all across the U.S. saying, hey, could you please send this information out to your listserv? I have, you know, youth blocks. We get 30, 40 blocks per workshop, and it literally takes 10 to 15 hours per block. Then on Instagram account, I'll make a, hey, we're looking for embroidery volunteers. People will sign up, and then they'll repost while they're embroidering the block, and then their friends will sign up. Then when quilts are finished, I'll tag all the embroidery volunteers who embroidered the youth art, and it just gets shared and shared. And honestly, we have over 300 volunteers all across the U.S.
This is just a wonderful project. I just have to say that. What are your plans for moving forward? Expansion?
Yeah, I really would want to get it set up in one school full time, class, but maybe an elective. Additionally, since I'm in California, I'd love to be able to provide this free activism art programming to particularly all the Title I, you know, low-income or like underfunded schools. For that matter, just because sewing is such an affluent hobby, most public schools don't keep sewing machines, and the need for sewing has died given the cheap labor we get in other countries, which makes clothes. Like, it's more expensive to make a quilt than it is to buy a quilt. It's more expensive to make clothes than it is to just buy them. So the cost effectiveness of sewing has really died, which makes it a dying hobby in a sense of, you know, kids of color particularly aren't sewing. Like, it's such an associated, affluent hobby that most people don't have sewing machines. And fabric's $12 to $15 a yard, so it's really expensive. So, therefore, a lot of kids don't have access.
When you buy a sewing machine, do you ever buy used or refurbished ones?
Always.
Oh, you do?
From local quilt stores, yes.
So, when you mention these local quilt stores, I guess I've never been to one. There are quilt stores that have sewing machines, fabrics, and related, you know, accessories?
Yep. They're just local quilt stores, usually like mom-pop, really small businesses. They have sewing machines because they offer classes, so they'll hire a quilt instructor to come in and teach people. But again, those sewing classes usually range from $150 to, you know, $150 to $300. They're really expensive. And kids typically aren't not necessarily welcomed, but it's just you have to have a prior knowledge and foundation of sewing to come in and take these classes.
I see. Different level or different audience.
Exactly.
Now, I'm just curious, do you ever see students focusing on an issue of, say, homelessness?
Yes, in the Bay Area especially. People care about Oakland homelessness. They care about in L.A. Kids really care about homelessness. And then additionally, in Oakland, we have a really big population of sex trafficking. Girls are being sex trafficked on the street called International, where you can just see young prostitutes. So kids really care about that, this culture of pimps and just exploiting women, especially young women. is really prevalent. So a lot of people are like, I really, you know, want to help fix homelessness and mental illness, destigmatizing mental health.
Sarah, who was a mentor or an inspiration to you as you were growing up?
Actually, I had two. I had in my church a woman named Laverne Edwards, who was a retired art professor, and she mentored and tooled me up in designing clothes. At this point, I can look at any dress in a magazine and know exactly how to draft a pattern to duplicate it. She tooled me up with hundreds of hours of just mentorship at her home, where I really can just, we can watch Project Runway, we can pause the show, sketch it, and make it. So I think in terms of just design and seam allowances and being able to deconstruct garments without physically having examples, she's been the most stellar example of that. But then additionally, based on the newspaper ad that we put out for Grace Temple, a white woman named Eleanor O'Donnell became my sewing mentor from in terms of quilts. She taught me how to paper piece, raw edge applique, quarter-inch seams, how to make perfect quilts. And the interesting thing is Laverne doesn't make quilts and Eleanor doesn't make clothes. So between the two of them, I've had this really holistic, well-rounded exposure to sewing education from two serious professionals.
You are a remarkable woman, Sarah. I just love this program, and we're running out of time. Is there anything that we haven't discussed that you'd like to let our audience know about?
I'd say there's ways to just get involved. I think I'd encourage anyone to look at the website, which is sjsacademy.com. If you know how to sew, you know, we can mail you out a block, you can embroider and amplify youth voice. If you have a group of kids that you're familiar with, we'd love to come to a workshop there. It doesn't matter where it is. We have, like, I can go there, but we have enough core team staff set up in Boston, Chicago. Like, depending on where we are, we could definitely make a workshop happen with a Girl Scout group or high school or after school program, anything like that. And even more than that, if you don't have a niche of young people or you don't know how to sew, we'd love to bring the quilts near you. To host the art is so powerful, just to give the kids quilts and just blocks and mini art quilts, just exposure. The art show is really powerful. We have over 25 quilts made by young people, again, who've never sewn before. So, but regardless of their lack of sewing preparation, the quilts aren't rudimentary. They're really powerful pieces of art that can inspire and create conversations and dialogue about issues that, you know, you might not be talking about.
Sarah, congratulations on this wonderful initiative. We'd love to have you back on again and just wish you all the best of luck in your continued endeavors.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.